Welcome to the Out of the Woods podcast, the top five headlines threat hunters need to be thinking of this week.
Hey everyone, welcome to our weekly edition of the Out of the Woods Threat Hunting Podcast. This is Scott Poley flying solo today. So I'm going to be kind of bringing up this week's weekly segment of the top five stories that threat hunters need to be thinking about, as well as our thoughts on the subject and some of the hunting strategies. So with that, I'm going to dive into the top five threat hunting headlines for the week of March 4th, 2024. So the first thing I really wanted to start off with was an interesting article that I read on Security Affairs, and it was titled, "The U.S. Judge Ordered NSO Group to Hand Over the Pegasus Spyware Code to WhatsApp." And for those that don't know who the NSO Group is, it's an Israeli surveillance firm, and they are the ones that created different types of spyware, one of the most notorious being Pegasus spyware, because it's really successful at compromising iPhones. And in particular ways, they're exploiting things that require no interaction. So I guess there was a legal proceedings associated between Facebook, or, you know, Meta now, and how the NSO group was actually exploiting their WhatsApp app to the point where a judge ruled that they had to release the source code of Pegasus so that they can potentially address or handle issues associated with their WhatsApp app. I think this is kind of an interesting article, only because the premise is you usually have offensive firms developing potential exploit code and research and things like that. But then there is some sort of, I would say, better faith on how that stuff can be utilized. Now, a lot of the customers of this group are usually governments around the world to do their own reconnaissance and spying, so to speak, on certain individuals. But there still is, I think, a little more transparency that can be had versus if people were to take all this type of development and just work purely on kind of the black market of offensive tools, where it's a lot harder for people to know what's going on. And there's probably maybe just as much money to be made to think of it. So that was kind of an interesting take, that was kind of forcing that change. So that was kind of what I really want to pull out from that one is, if you don't know what Pegasus is, it's really worth looking into. There's a ton of articles and reports about it and different points in time and who they were targeting and why. It's kind of interesting to see things like this handle where, you have actually court-ordered issues for source code for offensive tooling to different victims potentially or so forth. So that's all I'm going to cover for that one. The next one I really want to dive into was from Trend Micro. This one's kind of interesting. It's a decent technical write-up as far as what they were seeing. But this is really about RA World, which was previously known as RA Group. And basically, they were breaching targets worldwide with many targets really residing in the U.S. And they really seem to focus a lot on healthcare and financial sectors, probably because there's more of a likelihood for better or more reliable payout. But their chain of attacks, they had their whole attack and it was broken out in stages. And the interesting thing with the stages was they mentioned the initial access piece in the report. And this stood out to me because they said the initial access was they gained access to a compromised domain controller. That's not what I would typically say was initial access, because usually a lot of efforts go into, once you get into the network, trying to establish access to a domain controller. So it might not be your end goal, but it's definitely usually in the middle of your attack. And the only reason I would think that they would either say this was their initial access was just access to the domain controller, assuming it wasn't just something publicly exposed and exploited, was either there wasn't a lot of investigation that went into the initial access piece. Like, where they picked up on it was, you know, potentially where the domain controller was compromised. Or, you know, a lot of ransomware groups work with initial access brokers. And what that means is there are other criminal organizations that are really good at gaining access to things and then selling that access. So I don't know if that's the case here, but that would make sense why that initial access wasn't really tied as far as into the network to the RA World group. So it's something to take note of there. But one of the things they did with their attacks was they really leveraged a lot of group policy to access and execute their payloads. So something to really take note of here is for them to actually move their payloads around in a network, they have to be taking advantage of the SysVol, S-Y-S-V-O-L path, which is basically a share that's available across the domain. And these shares are located on domain controllers, but they're like publicly accessible. And they get replicated across domain controllers too, because that's how a lot of objects and things in the domain get managed and pushed throughout the network, is usually with the SysVol path. Well, that's where they were staging and dropping their payloads they wanted to deploy across the domain. So looking for interesting things that actually land in SysVol. So if you get up, set up some monitoring, I know SysVol is really good for detecting file creations and things like that. You can do some auditing within Windows for file creations on certain directories as well, but it can be very verbose. But looking specifically for executables like EXEs, for instance, hitting the SysVol path are at least good notes to have record of, because if you're not actually logging that, you will never be able to know it even happened. So that's one thing to like kind of keep an eye out for. The other thing that really stood out as well is the first stager, when it dropped and was executed, it would pull down the additional payloads to the endpoint, and it would usually drop them in the environment variable winder, which basically is the location where Windows is installed. So usually it would be like C Windows as the directory, and they put it in the help directory. So it'd be C Windows help. And they basically dropped two other executables. One was an exclude, it said finish exe, and one was exclude exe. The finish one was interesting because it really was just a hello world executable. So it really, more the name was more important than anything else, I think. So that was a way for them to know that they've already hit this target or they don't need to run the ransomware. This is interesting because I know a lot of things people do is they create what they call like malware or ransomware vaccines. And a lot of times they do it with mutexes, where if they were able to create mutexes in the system, then when a malware looks for that mutex to see if it's infected, it will say, oh, you already are, and then stop, you know, interacting. Another good example doing some similar technique is WannaCry. You know, WannaCry, when it was going rampant across the internet, there was a specific domain that was actually trying to reach out to that would never resolve because the domain wasn't actually live. Well, once a researcher saw that and actually stood up that domain and it did resolve, the ransomware stopped working. That was like almost this kill switch. So finding things like that are interesting. So for instance, if it's looking for a finish.exe in that directory, if you were just to create that file, I don't even know if it has to really truly be the exe. You might potentially, with this specific wave, until they adjust their techniques, kind of prevent the attack from actually succeeding, or, you know, disarming the attack. So that's something that was interesting to note. But then, you know, when they, you know, executed their stage one, that would usually drop the stage two, and they named them this way, at least according to the article they did, which was interesting. And stage two was interesting because the second stage of this ransomware actually looked to try to determine if the system was running in safe mode. And the only reason it did that was because it wanted to put the system into safe mode, but also create a service where that would run in safe mode with network connectivity. So that basically it would check to see if it's in safe mode. If it wasn't, create the service so that when it reboot in safe mode, it would rerun the executable past that first check and then continue its activities. And I've seen, and I don't know if it was this group before, but I've seen SafeMode being utilized by ransomware groups. And one of the main reasons why a lot of groups may like to try to execute their ransomware with SafeMode is it's a much easier way to turn off some of those checks and balances that are in the system that may impede the ransomware from achieving its ultimate goal. It's just a quick and dirty way to say, well, let's turn off all these services and things that usually run, because SafeMode is more of like a run just what you need type mode, because you're usually trying to fix something that is breaking. And so you're just basically running on bare bones. So a lot of times your security stuff isn't even running in safe mode. So that was one of the reasons why they're doing that. But the other thing, when I mentioned creating a service that I really like to see here for their specific behavior, was it wasn't about creating a service using the typical utilities you see. Like, you don't see SC create and then a service and so forth. They actually directly created the registry keys and put the parameters in the registry to stand up the service, which isn't as normal for a lot of these groups using services, but it gives you something really good to look for. So, for instance, I mentioned they like to be in safe mode with network access. That's kind of their desired state to run the ransomware. So that service, when they create it, the services will be seen listed. And when you look at the registry key, if you're looking for the local machine hive, it's in the system concurrent control set, which is basically what's the configuration that's going to be running currently. Then it's going to be control safeboot/network. And then whatever service name you want to drop in there to say, this is where we want the service to run. That's so anything, basically, if you're looking for a safeboot/network as a registry key, and you see that being modified, that would be really rare, right? Because a lot of services aren't being built for safe mode because the system usually isn't running in safe mode. So I thought that was a big key identifier. And then the other thing is once it gets in safe mode, then it actually runs stage 3, which is the actual ransomware. And I don't know if it was part of the end of stage 2 or in stage 3, but there was a lot of cleanup that happened. Granted, the cleanup isn't really going to help you detect anything potentially to prevent any actions, but just aware that all those registry artifacts that we just talked about and some of the payloads that get dropped will actually get deleted. So a pretty good write-up, some interesting notes. It looks like I wouldn't say the most sophisticated ransomware group out there, but obviously they're being really effective, and they're, you know, some of the shortcuts they're taking in order to achieve success, like for instance, the safe boot things and so forth, are very identifiable. And also I think how they're doing it might be more detectable. So something to take note of, but it was an interesting article, and it's good to keep up with how different groups are working. So those are kind of my highlights there. All right. So now jumping to our third topic. Yeah, this one is an interesting one. It's more topical. So it's an article from HelpNet Security, and it looked like they dove into a group IB report, but they kind of focused, at least in the top part and the part I want to talk about, was based on the title, really, Cyber Criminals Harness AI for New Era of Malware Development, which is funny because it's kind of misleading based on some of the bullet points they pulled out. But it grabbed my attention because it was really about how are actors and malware authors leveraging potential AI capabilities. And so one of the things they kind of had right at the top as one of the graphics, so what are the top five discussed things on the underground forums that, you know, people were interested in from those adversaries. And one was the technical consultant, which I thought was funny because that's what us, at least myself, I use some of the, you know, ChatGPT type stuff and other AI implementations to help with, almost like a sounding board to make sure I'm thinking about things correctly, understanding things correctly. Another one was pretty obvious to me too, was text and media generation for scams. Let's be honest, that's probably the most easily used method of using AI, is generating things for scams. And then one of the other things I saw was intelligence gathering and recon. So this was interesting because, you know, I know depending on what your target is, this could be a great resource, But obviously, there's a lot of things that could be dated too. So depending on how current your target is, or how long you've been stalking your target, and so forth, that might have mixed bag of results. And then the other one there were a lot of chat about was abilities to remain anonymous, which I was kind of interested in this because I was kind of curious what they were using these AI models to help them become anonymous. And maybe it's just some of their processes or things to consider, or how can I not be seen by doing this? And the AI gives them suggestions, maybe. I'm not sure. And the last one was just as obvious as the text and media for scans was a lot of the deepfake and impersonations. You know, I think I've seen a lot more reporting recently where people are falling for these types of deepfakes, for wire fraud and so forth. So, you know, those are the top five things they mentioned. But they also had some other interesting things in the article that I liked. One is they did note they saw an uptick in zero-day sales by 70% in general on the underground forums, which is kind of a lot. It means a lot of people are spending time there. But then they also mentioned something else to kind of pair that with when they talked about what were some of the models most discussed. And they're, I believe it's called WolfGPT. And it was specifically built to try to help with code development and identifying exploits. And that was the least discussed model. And part of the reason was due to the complexities and usability, just in training alone to make sure the model was actually effective, which kind of goes back to where my opinion was already when people really started kind of coming unhinged about, look what we're going to be able to enable attackers to do with all these models and things. And it kind of goes to show that, yes, that is a realistic threat, but not something you would should spend your time on. So I'm kind of the person where you should really spend a lot of your time on the near risk, not the risk that's out of reach. And so I would look at, you know, how to manage the AI stuff that's going to enable people to code better or build malware better. That's more of the risk out of reach. I think if you're doing everything right, you'd be addressing some of those risks right now without having to do anything beyond what you're already doing if you have a good plan. So that was an interesting anecdote, because there was more zero-day sales, but it didn't seem like it was really attributed to a lot of the modeling that was being shared and talked about. And then something else that was also, I thought, worth noting was they saw a lot of targeting of, when they look at credential stealing, actually trying to steal ChatGPT creds. Like, that was a common cred that was sought after. And this is primarily because they know that a lot of people use ChatGPT. And if you work for a business or a company, then you know that you're probably using it to help with your work. And they were looking to try to steal proprietary stuff that way, where you had historical chats, where maybe you had, because, you know, ChatGPT is set up in a way where every time you want to tackle a new problem, you create a new chat, right? And unless you're managing your chats, those other chats are still there. So that hygiene, right? If you're going to be potentially using ChatGPT to disclose maybe what you do on a day-to-day or how you work or what you care about, maybe hopefully not putting, you know, any of your company information actually in ChatGPT, you're a little more obscure about it. Hopefully that if you're doing that, once you get your answers and you follow through, you're deleting it just because you don't have that running record. And if it's something you feel like you need that kind of persists, one of the techniques I've actually used for this is when I finish a chat and I'm like, you know, I'm probably going to revisit this, or I haven't really fully solved the problem, but, you know, I need to move on to something else. I got far enough. I'll typically ask ChatGPT, hey, can you kind of summarize this conversation and help me develop a prompt so that if I want to revisit this conversation, I know I can put this prompt in and you'll be kind of caught up to what we were talking about before so that I can continue the conversation and you have some insight. And it's pretty good at doing that. And then I just save that prompt somewhere else, because usually that prompt's so summarized that if someone were to actually see it on a, you know, a document or something somewhere and discover it that way, it might not be that insightful. And it also keeps it off of what people are targeting as far as trying to get into other people's ChatGPTs for information, something you can't control as easily. So those are some of the highlights from that I thought really interesting. But it's nice to know people are at least aware of what they're talking about on the ground forums as far as potential for AI in that capacity. So it'll be interesting to see how that changes over time. And then the fourth article I really wanted to kind of bring up, I thought this was interesting. It was from Malwarebytes. It's titled Malicious Meeting Invite Fix Targets Mac Users. And really what it was about was there was cyber criminals that were basically targeting Mac users, acting like they were some cryptocurrency firm that they wanted to get them excited about cryptocurrency and lure them in and say, look at what we can do for you, and try to set up a meeting. And sometimes they're reaching out through Telegram and things to kind of set some of this stuff up. So it was their initial communication. And then they would get the meeting set up on a calendar, and they would, the link they would provide for this meeting would look like a valid link, but no one ever checks the link until the day of the meeting, and the link would actually be broken. It would make it look broken. And then, you know, they already had the initial communication through Telegram or whatnot. So you reach back out and say, hey, you know, this doesn't work. And they'd be like, oh, this happens all the time. And then they would share what they call an Apple script file or Apple script applet. And in doing so, the person would think, oh, this will fix the meeting thing. But when they go to run that, it usually will prompt for administrative privileges. So you'll kind of have to put in your password to run things. And now whatever that script is intending to do now has all the privileges on your machine to either pull down more payloads, to do more things. And so it was really an interesting social engineer technique. But I thought it was interesting that you kind of use the, hey, I don't want to run something malicious. So people usually have their guard up front. So they first start with something really benign and broken to really establish trust. Because, you know, you're like, well, nothing bad's happened so far. So when they try to help me down the road, it's almost like because you feel like you know the person now, because you've established some sort of form of communication, you're more likely to try to run things they pass to you when they're helping you with a problem versus just saying, hey, we got this really interesting, you know, thing. You should run this right away. You probably say no. So I liked that method of how they kind of manipulated people. It's something to kind of, in an interesting way, they really understand people a little more of that kind of attack. And then the other thing was, you know, how do you defend against something like this? Well, I'm not too familiar with all the different ways to have visibility on Mac products, but I do know that, you know, looking for .scpt files, that's usually Apple script files. Those are really good to keep an eye on in general, because any kind of scripting stuff is, you know, always good to keep an eye on. And for Apple's, that's it. But the other thing that's hard is if you actually turn that script file into an applet, it'll look like any other Mac app. And if that's the case, then you won't really be able to identify very easily that it's a script file because it's kind of contained within the applet, and they can sign it with a credential. They can have all this other metadata that looks fairly normal. And so what they were saying, which might be kind of hard, were look for instances for domains that may be associated with meeting support sites. But that's really kind of hard to do. So it kind of depends on the visibility you have in general in your environment for that kind of stuff. But, you know, it's good to know people are being targeted this way. And, you know, there's at least some artifacts that are worth taking note of, because I'm sure the .scpt files, the Apple script files, looking for those in general might even cover down on some other types of attacks that could happen in the future or even in the past. So that was noteworthy for me. All right. Now, to get to the last topic, and this one was kind of interesting to me, which typically a lot of people don't find these that interesting, including myself, but this is actually Security Affairs made mention of this. But basically, the U.S. Cybersecurity Infrastructure Security Agency, also known as CISA, they added the MicroStrife streaming service vulnerability to its known exploited vulnerabilities catalog. So we talked about this catalog before on here. And it's a really good catalog, and it's really important to be aware of, because things that make this list are typically, I would say, highly reliable. So if you have a vulnerability management program, it's good to have this as part of you, because I know everyone, when they do risk scoring for vulnerability management, it's not usually just what's the public score. It's more, let's take that public score, do some of our own risk rating internally to figure out how we would handle this problem. And then you come up with your final internal score of that problem. Well, if something is in this catalog, I think that should be a score that gets, or some sort of weight that gets adjusted to your scoring calculations. Because that means that with high confidence, adversaries are using this. And to kind of add another perspective to this. So one of the things that I did was I went to the catalog and actually looked at this vulnerability. And if you're, you know, curious what the vulnerability is that I'm talking about, it's the CVE 2023-029-360, which really pertains to the Microsoft kernel streaming server driver, which basically helps you stream media on your PC, capture things from your microphone, play things over your speakers. It kind of is that fundamental, like, multimedia driver, essentially. But it lets people basically escalate to system-level privileges when people are able to exploit this. And there is, you know, exploit code that I was able to find on GitHub very easily. But when you look at the sources, when you go to the catalog for this specific vulnerability of, like, why they put this in there, they basically mentioned the Microsoft article for their update guide for, you know, this specific vulnerability. And the last time it was updated, that article from Microsoft, it was in August of 2023. And in their article, it said there was no signs of exploitation. And then CSET added this to the catalog with no references to, you know, the information of who or where this was being exploited on February 29th, 2024, which is, you know, like 5 days ago or less. And so that means they have information they may or may not be able to share where they're seeing this activity happening. And you're not really seeing it publicly being mentioned. So that can mean a couple different things. If it's true, they have high confidence that this is actually happening, is it's a very targeted attack, hitting, you know, entities big enough where people should really care, or adversaries that are more likely to use this in the future. And also maybe reporting hasn't picked up on it yet. Right. So maybe it's actually happening in a more wider spread, capacity, but since it hasn't been discovered, you're not seeing it as much. And so it kind of, why I bring it up that way is clearly they have some information that they maybe can't share, but that should make you see this as, oh, this is probably important if they think it's important, when I don't see this being reported anywhere else, including the source they provided about it, because they're not going to put it on there otherwise. So, you know, to kind of add some gravity and kind of how I look at some of these reportings, I mean, it is a government entity. They do get to pass information on, if not the specifics, for things to worry about and care about. So I would take these things seriously, and it's a good catalog to be aware of. So that's kind of what I want to leave everybody with, is, you know, make sure you're paying attention to these types of things, and try to understand, you know, why maybe you're seeing this here, not anywhere else. You know, sometimes trying to answer those questions can be very insightful. So before I close out, though, I do want to make a mention that we're also doing a workshop, Hunting for Initial Access. It's going to be hosted by Lee Arkinall. He's done a lot of those in the past, and it's one of those ones that's interactive. You get access to data, walk us through some hunts. It's a great practical way of learning some threat hunting and also getting exposed to some techniques and data. So I definitely think you guys should check that out. That's going to be on March 20th from 12 to 1 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. And if not, you can always try to go through any recorded sessions and things later, but make sure to register so it's easy to find those materials. And then just want to really thank everyone for joining this week's episode of the Out of the Woods Threat Hunting Podcast. I really look forward to syncing back up next week. Sorry I was just solo, and hopefully my rambling didn't bore you to death, but hopefully you had something to walk away with. So with that, we'll close out the top five threat hunting headlines for the week of March 4th, 2024. Happy hunting, everyone.
Thanks for listening to the Out of the Woods podcast. Be sure to subscribe wherever you heard this podcast so you never miss an episode. For more information or to connect with Cyborg Security, check us out online at www.cyborgsecurity.com and follow us on social media. We'll see you next time.